This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
They say tragedy is a hard teacher. In Cranford, New Jersey, on a night very recently in September, that lesson was absolutely brutal. Two young lives lost, and a chorus of unanswered pleas now echoing in the hollow left behind. 7-year-olds Maria Notis and Isabella Salas were riding home on electric bikes not far from familiar streets when they were struck by a vehicle around 5:26 to 5:30 p.m. on Burnside Avenue. That vehicle, authorities now report, was a black 2021 Jeep Compass. The girls were rushed to area hospitals, but both succumbed to their injuries. By nightfall, law enforcement had detained a 17-year-old boy from Garwood, New Jersey. 2 days later, prosecutors filed two counts of first-degree murder. Because he's a minor, his identity has remained shielded from public release, at least for now. Horrible accident, right? 17-year-old, newly driving, doesn't know what they're doing very well. Oh my gosh. Was it that? Or were there a lot of warning signs this guy was capable of doing something like this on purpose? I'm not pulling that out of thin air. From the earliest hours of community grief, the focus turned outward, not just on the crash, but on what preceded the crash. Neighbors, friends, parents began to say warning signs were sounded, the danger was visible, and the system was told, see something, say something. And still no effective intervention happened. Well, this is a 17-year-old behind the wheel of a vehicle. What do you mean? Well, one neighbor told Fox 5 he was parked outside of her house in school and online. Another said the school was notified for like 3 months about stalking type behavior. A friend, Tammy Cargibal, told CBS News she made complaints and nothing was done. Some local outlets report that Maria filed a restraining order against the suspect, though prosecutors have declined to comment on that publicly. So the person who struck the girls had allegedly been stalking them for weeks, months. When the voices cried out ahead of the crime and no door opened, we got to ask, did the law allow that in action? Was there a choice not to act? Or did it work just as the system was designed? Meaning, no action by design. Because we're in a system where, yeah, we have the warning signs, we see something, we say something, but you can't often do something until something horrible happens. And how long are we wanting to stay in the system like this? Or is this system the best system? And things like this will happen when we're living in that type of a society and that type of a system. Or can we use more common sense? Is there a gray area? Is there somewhere in the middle here where chosen ignorance doesn't have to be the explanation for inaction? From what's documented, officials have largely remained silent on earlier reports. The Union County Prosecutor's Office in Cranford, police have declined to release records indicating receipt of stalking complaints, restraining orders, incidents reports, or police calls related to harassment. So we got to keep a good close eye on that. Because if all these people are saying, we let you know, and you're like, we don't have any record of that, and I'm not saying they're saying that by any means, but I'm saying this is something people, They don't like being held accountable. In general, people don't like being held accountable. And they don't like people pointing out inefficiencies or missed chances to do their job. If, again, like I said, I'm not trying to go completely scorched earth on the police here. We don't know enough yet. Sometimes this is just how our system works. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying we have to deal with reality on reality's terms. And if that's how the system was designed to work and they had their hands tied, I mean, you can't expect someone to go arrest a 17-year-old if they were not technically doing anything that you could arrest them for. Stalking is a crime. You're exactly right, it is. And if that was not pursued, if that was ignored, then you have a case. But was it? That's why we have to ask questions and wait for answers. And not always just take the answers at face value either. But again, deep breath, take the information in before we react. The public statements have emphasized the ongoing investigation, surveillance video requests, and tip lines, but offered little about prior engagement. The vacuum, the reluctance or refusal to disclose what was or wasn't on file, raises a deeper, uncomfortable possibility that no formal complaint ever met the standard for a criminal case or restraining order, or that officials believed on paper there was nothing actionable. In simpler terms, victims and their advocates may have spoken, but the system, constrained by legal thresholds and evidentiary burdens, may have found little they could actually act upon or chose not to escalate. Stalking laws often require a pattern of repeated behavior, threats, or a credible fear. A single report may have been recorded but not investigated aggressively unless there is corroborating evidence. This is why you need to report things. Well, nothing ever happens. Here's a prime example. Why? What do you mean? Because patterns are what can make things happen. Patterns are what can be proven. Patterns are what can be shown. And patterns are what can make people take action and make an officer go from, well, it's another complaint over here, first time I ever heard of that, versus, well, this is this 30th complaint. Let's do something. And I'm not saying there was 30 complaints, just throwing it out there as an example. Patterns matter, recording things matter, keeping track and getting it in the right hands of the right people and keeping your own log and all of that, so important in anything in life. If you want to prove your point, because your voice just being loud out there, it only goes so far. At the end of the day, people are going to want receipts. They're going to want evidence. And maybe that evidence is there. Schools, for their part, can document complaints, assign counselors or resource officers, or shift scheduling, but often hesitate to discipline unless a policy violation or threat is clear. In many jurisdictions, resource constraints, high caseloads, or a tendency to see teenage interpersonal conflicts as drama lead to under-response. And that is so damn true. It's kids being kids and people not recognizing some of those kids are monsters. Some of those kids are evil. Some of those kids shouldn't be around the other kids because they're not just going to grow out of it. But nobody wants to admit that, especially the parents of the little monsters. Yet the repeated nature of the allegations here, neighbors saying month-long parking outside of the house, school presence, online contact suggests escalation. If no records exist, the question becomes whether the system was willing to look deeper. Did someone classify the reports as non-criminal? Did the police desk reject a report for lack of probable cause? Did school administrators refuse to document or share it to avoid liability? We do not have published answers to those questions. But they are all questions that need to be asked here. What we do know, after the crash, law enforcement immediately pivoted into high gear. They asked for video surveillance from homes, doorbells, dash cams. They sought footage from the Jeep Compass before, during, after the collision. They issued tip lines. They publicized the case. They arrested. They charged. The system mobilized. But too late. In other words, the system responded decisively after the worst possible moment, which that is how the system does seem to be designed to do, unfortunately. But before it, when the warnings were alive, there's no public record of system-level intervention. One further dimension complicates the public's trust. A personal tie between the suspect and the Westfield police chief. Now, multiple credible outlets report that the suspect is a relative of the chief, though not his son or part of his immediate family. And look, that's all we know right now is that there's a connection. It doesn't mean there's any special treatment going on. One of the local news stations, News 12, specifically reports that local community sources believe the suspect is the chief's nephew. In a public statement, the chief confirmed the relation, but strongly denies any familial or professional bias. He said he and his family do not condone or excuse the act and called for the suspect to face full accountability. Good. And I hope that that all stands up to scrutiny. When your records are subpoenaed and people do take a look at the warning signs, the complaints, if they exist, that it will truly show that there is no reason that this suspect was not investigated further because of something like, you know, oh, he's a good boy, he's my nephew. I really hope that that's not the case. And it very well may be not the case. Again, we don't know. It's again, it's one of those low-hanging fruits in a case like this that people are always so quick to jump at, going, well, they're related to a cop. It must be a cover-up. No. I'm related to cops, too. And believe me, I'm the first person to go, there's a freaking cover-up going on here, and there needs to be some repercussions. There's a lot of good cops out there, too, that are looking to expose and get rid of the crap, whose hands are tied, who may be a father, who saw the type of behavior but knew there was only so much they could legally do. And that's where the system would need some changes. And the system does need some changes. The presence of that relationship, though, even if public statements insist on separation, raises reasonable questions in the narrative of inaction. Did any pushback or reluctance emerge initially or internally when complaints might implicate someone connected to active law enforcement leadership? We're not crazy for asking those questions because we've seen it. Not saying it's happening here, but it's not a crazy question to ask. And it seems as of right now, he's happy to answer it. So far on the up and up. Good. We'll need to keep asking those questions. And we're going to need to see the receipts. Did local police influence prosecutorial discretion? None of these are documented for public consumption as of now. Still, the optics are stark. A teen accused of plotting violence against a peer connected to power in the region with repeated warnings. Little visible forward motion until catastrophe strikes. It looks horrible. Let's hope it's not that bad, but at the end, two girls are dead. So whatever reason inaction did not take place, or inaction did take place, because inaction, however you say it, we got to figure that out. Because apparently this guy didn't just kind of come out of the woodwork. The suspect's choices remain central. He allegedly stalked, he allegedly harassed, he allegedly planned, according to the victim's families. He plotted this attack against Maria for months. At least one family statement insisted he is not insane. He is competent and he was planning this. The families demanded that this not be framed as an accident or simple hit and run, but as a murder in the first degree. By choosing to drive into two friends, by choosing to flee rather than render aid, by choosing to remain anonymous until investigators pressured the case, he made a cascade of decisions, each decision stacked on the one before. But so did the system. The system that hears cries but declines to record them. The system that requires proof that often can only be assembled after violence. The system that defers to resource constraints, policy limits, or risk aversion. The system that often tells teenage survivors, your fear is not a case until it becomes one. The case forces us to ask, if nothing in the formal record existed before the crash, did the system fail to see its own gaps? If those records did exist, why haven't they been released? And if the suspect has a connection with a nearby police chief, was there a chilling effect on investigations? We do not know whether a restraining order was served or fully enforced, whether police ever visited the suspect's home, or whether intervening conversations were had with the suspect's family. Those are discovery questions for trial or internal audits. But from what the public has seen, the system's response until the moment of death was muted, inert, if present at all. When people say they feel unsafe, they require more than acknowledgement. They require action. Recording the complaint is not enough when it goes nowhere. Assigning someone to follow up is not enough when the follow-ups never happened. Maria's friends and neighbors insisted they spoke. They alleged the school was notified. The neighbor saw the car outside the home, a teenage girl living in fear, asking for protection, perhaps told internally her case was too weak or not worthy of evaluation. That is where accountability must lie, not just with the driver, but with every gatekeeper who declined to open it. The connection to the chief is not proof of bias, but it is a lens through which we must scrutinize the law enforcement involvement. If internal records or personal decisions prevented or delayed action, need scrutiny. And if those in power refuse to examine conflict because of a relation, that's injustice in plain sight. The suspect's violence now lies before court, but the system's omissions, the choices not to respond, the silence in the face of repeated warnings, those lie before all of us. And in the court of community memory, let this not be a cautionary tale only. Let it be a call that when someone whispers fear, no matter their age, we owe it to them to listen and to act. Maria and Isabella are gone now, but if a system did not fail them when it could have, then we will fail all the others who follow. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not there already, join us. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you will find us there. Same search wherever you're getting podcasts. If you're already watching us on YouTube, you want to take us on the audio version, just search that podcast and press subscribe. Until next time, I am Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.